Yeah, thank you. Good morning, everyone. As we're approaching Tisha B'Av, the window of time in which the Mashiach can come is getting smaller and smaller, at least before the 9th of Av. There's still a chance, there's still a possibility. And of course, even if we're not Zocha to a Geula Shlema, we could be Zocha to a smaller Geula, one in which our enemies will be defeated, and our Chayolim and the rest of Achenu B'nei Israel will be safe. I had just seen the news that the Chayol that we thought was captured was announced to be dead. Who knows what's going on? And who knows what's better? It's an impossible situation. But we hope at least that the family should have much nechama, much comfort, together with all the other families of the Chayolim that have died. Again, if we needed to be reminded about the Chorban Beis HaMikdash and the sadness of this period of time, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is giving us experiences to make it very, very vivid to us. If I could just take a few moments to talk about something that's a little less important, I want to bring up a personal matter that in the overall perspective of things is really not important, but maybe it is important. The Gemara tells us, Al Kamtzu Bar Kamtzu Charev Yerushalayim. If you remember the story, the events that ultimately culminated in the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash involved a personal rivalry that doesn't seem to have been a big deal. There was a man who was making a party, and the man had a good friend who was Kamtza, and he had an enemy that was Bar Kamtza, and the servants sent the invitation to the wrong guy. Bar Kamtza shows up. The Balabayas is very upset. He orders him to leave. And Bar Kamtza says, please do not embarrass me. Do not shame me. I'll pay for my food. I'll pay for half of the party. I'll pay for the whole party. The person said, get out of here. And he took him physically. He threw him out of the room. And because of this, Bar Kamtza started reporting to the Romans that the Jews were not faithful. Now, Bar Kamtza probably did not think that this will culminate in the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. He figured maybe there would be a fine or whatever it would be. But this set into this little event, which is, of course, emblematic of embarrassing, humiliating people, sinas chinam. This little event perpetrated the sequence of events that culminated in the Churban Beis HaMikdash. This is what Chazal called kocho shelbusha, what embarrassing someone can do. So little things, but little things can have very, very big consequences. I feel bad doing this, but I really have no other avenue. That someone had sent me an anonymous letter criticizing me over a comment I made about President Obama, that Obama should be impeached. Now, first of all, I literally never made the statement. I did not make the statement at all. I made a little joke when I was talking about Richard Nixon that maybe, compared to what we have now, perhaps we should miss the old days of Richard Nixon. That's the only thing I ever said about Obama. I absolutely did not say he should be impeached. And as a lawyer, I have to say that whatever my views, there's no legal grounds to impeach Obama unless he was born in Kenya, but that's a separate matter. But second of all, so the letter number one made a false accusation. It was anonymous. But number two, in the letter, there were a number of statements about my being a racist, that it was connected to the fact that he's African American, and the fact that some people serve Israel with a helmet as opposed to a black hat, which is attacking my feelings for Eretz Yisrael. I was accused of being ignorant about American politics, which I'm really not, but okay, that's not the
anonymous sign, yeah, yeah. The name.
So here is my point. My point basically is that if someone has a criticism, number one, they should try to be accurate. That's first and foremost. But number two, they should have the courage to sign. Now, if the argument is they do not want to be embarrassed, well, apparently they're willing to embarrass me. Now, rabbis have feelings too, and I just want to say that the tone of this letter went way beyond the way I've ever spoken to a student, including a student that might be 10 years old. So it's not a question of asking for kavod. I am not asking for kavod. I'm asking to be treated with the derech eretz that you treat any human being. And if this person is here, I just want to say that I hope that if you have need to give mussar to somebody, you also couple it with something positive. Now, I'm not fishing for compliments, but this was a letter in which you know, you say something like, you know, you give a good share, but I was a little concerned. You know, I get those letters, and that's fine. This was like not a single good word. So I hope for your sake of your husband and your children that when you have to give tochacha, you give tochacha in that way, because otherwise it's frankly very hurtful, very humiliating, and it does not make the point, besides the fact that it's not true, which is a separate, you know, that's a separate issue. So again, I do apologize, and I hate to use a shear for my personal grievances, but on the other hand, you know, in this period of time, I think we do need to be sensitive. If the person would like to contact me, please contact me, and I do apologize for even airing this publicly, but you've given me no choice because there was no signature to the letter. So be it as it may, Kamsa Bar Kamsa Charev Yerushalayim, it is a time in which we need to be very, very sensitive about this. I am not a racist, and in fact, okay, Chas Shalom. Everyone is entitled to their political views. I do not mean to squelch it, and my shir is not a forum for political discussion. I made a little joke, and I'm trying to figure out where did you extract from my remarks that Obama should be impeached. The only thing I can think of is I was talking about Richard Nixon. I was talking about the power of speech, and I just mentioned that even though Nixon was impeached, the thing he was thinking about were the taunts in the sixth grade playground. And then I said something about Obama. This brain linked the word impeachment with Obama. I absolutely never said it, and the tape of that share is available. Yes?
I wasn't here. I just arrived from the States. But people hear what they want to hear.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
And it goes in, and they spread that when there isn't even a foundation.
There was no foundation, and once again, and by the way, there was a taunt there about if I think Obama's bad, Hillary Clinton will be the next president. Okay, whatever. This, at some point, it just went on and on. But the point, I'm going to stop my share now. The reason I was debating very much whether I should bring this up, and I thought at the end, I really agonized almost a week over this. But I thought, in light of the Kamsa Bar Kamsa story, it does have a shaychus to the idea of Tisha B'Av.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You must take into account how many strange people there are in Jerusalem.
Okay, all right. Well, you know, that in the, I don't know if it's an official, I don't think it's an official psychiatric disorder, but there is something called the Jerusalem Syndrome. We've taken some of our students to Kfar Shaul. Yeah.
Incorrect, even though they represent it. This is something that having been raised and grew up at Arachim, the whole large part of the population violates, at the same time lying, cheating, stealing, in the papers, this business with the tax credits for children with Americans that ran through certain sections of the community.
Yeah.
No self, a self. And these values are ignored, put behind a no fame, in other words, put behind a wall, and there is nobody within that community, L'Rasenu, in other words, to stop it, to hold it, and to deal with it.
Well, I just want to say, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, 170 years ago, started in Europe what was known as the Musar movement. And the purpose of the Musar movement was addressed to religious Jews, Shomer Shabbos Jews, to raise their consciousness of ethics, of morality, of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, of understanding that you're not just religious if you keep Shabbos and kosher. But part of being a religious Jew is the honesty, the integrity, and the derech eretz that you have.
Not
well, okay, we could.
There's one yeshiva that
I understand. So basically, we need, all of us need, and again, my point is not to criticize other people. I mean, I talk to myself too, and we should all talk to ourselves, but the question is to raise our ethical consciousnesses, to restore the idea of Mussar. Now, Mussar does exist in yeshivas in a very superficial way. They take 15 minutes a day where they learn a Mussar safer. But that's only part of it. I mean, Mussar is about character building. It is about honesty. It is about loving people and caring about people and not being negative on people. It's about seeing people with sechus favorably. It's trying to understand and build. We talked about a few weeks ago the kayach of words to build and give chizuk as opposed to words that destroy. So Rabbi Saul Salanter's insight has not gone away. Unfortunately, the problems that he identified in religious culture have gotten worse, and certainly in non-religious culture as well. It's interesting that even in the secular world, the non-religious Jewish world, they're trying to create a Mussar structure. There's a guy, Moranis, Alan Moranis, I think his name is, who's not even a Shomer Shabbos. But he's writing books on Mussar based on Rabbi Saul Salanter. Now, whether you can have Mussar divorced from Shmiras HaMitzvos is a very, very interesting question, but at least he's been honest to recognize that the world needs this kind of morality.
I just want to make a statement.
Yeah.
That your classes are probably the highest attended classes in the entire center here.
Well, I don't know. Okay.
So, yeah. If one person disagrees with something, you know, that's going to happen. When you're a great person, not everyone is going to agree with you.
Well, you know. No, but listen, I mean, you know, I didn't say this to get compliments. I didn't mean that. But I will say this. I will tell you that it's very important that when you ever have a need to criticize somebody, you put in a compliment. That's actually very important. When you talk to your children, talk to your husband, you always give tochacha by first building somebody up. And this is an element of human nature that is also in halacha, and it's something practical that we could take away in the 9 days. You don't point out somebody's deficiencies, even if they're true, unless you also build them up. And that's an extremely important idea in all chinuch. Chinuch has to come from building people up and not from just tearing them down. And that's true whether you're 6 or 60. A person needs that type of thing. Okay. And as they say, I'm willing, if anyone has any criticism or any taina or any argument, please feel free to talk to me or email me, and you know, we could at least have a dialogue. You know, when I give a halacha shir Tuesday, which was based on Rav Avadya Yosef. So before I started, I got a long letter basically criticizing my choice of Rav Avadya Yosef because of the various things he was involved in. And, you know, that hurt me also. For some reason, I'm attracting letters these days. But but because there was a name, we got into a discussion, and Baruch Hashem, at least by email, I don't actually know the person, but by email, we became friends. We had a very nice relationship of shalom in which we understood each other. And that's the way to do it, you know, even if the letter was harsh. But an anonymous letter like this really leaves me no choice. I could swallow it, and maybe if I'd been on a higher madrega, I would. But I thought there was an inyan in chinuch to actually share it as well for that reason. Okay, but let me go back. Okay, sorry. Again, please accept my apologies for using this for personal venting. But as I say, I think there is a toelis even in a certain amount of personal venting. Okay, be it as it may, you know, we are approaching the 9th of Av, and I've mentioned on Tuesday, I spoke a lot about Tisha B'Av on Tuesday, so I don't want to repeat it, a lot of you were there, but one statement I do want to repeat is a very fascinating statement of the Talmud Yerushalmi. The Talmud Yerushalmi says that any generation in which the Beis HaMikdash is not rebuilt is as guilty as the generation of the Chorban. Now, that is not an intuitively obvious statement. One might have thought, oh, the temple was destroyed because they had so many bad Averas. We're not so bad, but we don't have the super-duper merit that you need to get it back. That's what I might have thought. The Talmud Yerushalmi says that's not the case. The Talmud Yerushalmi says you don't need a special merit to get the Beis HaMikdash back. All you need easy enough, is to rectify the sins that caused its korban. And therefore, if there is no Beis HaMikdash, we are guilty by definition of the very same Averos that caused the korban. To put it in a more graphic way, it's not that the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, but every single second we are redestroying it. We are burning the Beis HaMikdash again and again and again and again. This is not a past event. We are doing it now. We are doing it this very minute because it's not here. We're doing it. So it's a very sobering thought, and in many ways, it's not so much of a difficulty to understand. Everyone knows Chazal's famous statement that the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar because of the three worst Averos, Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichas Damim. And that Galus only lasted 70 years. The second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed because of Sinas Chinam, hatred, polarization. And the Gemara says that Galus already lasted, in the time of the Gemara it was 1,000 years, and now let's add on another 1,200 years, as it were, almost 2,000 years, actually more than that. So the Gemara says, you see how powerful is Sinas Chinam. To ask ourselves, do we still live in a generation of Sinas Chinam? That's pretty obvious. We don't really have to bring proofs to this. The polarization, the dissension, the disunity, the name-calling, the embarrassments, the humiliation. Baruch Hashem, if there's any bracha in the difficult, difficult nisyonos that we face now, it is that perhaps it brings us a bit more together. And that itself is a bracha. It's a bracha within the darkness. It's an or within the choshech. That we have a sense of Achenu b'nei Yisrael, Achenu kol beis Yisrael, every day, hopefully three times a day in tefillas, in every shul. And yesterday, even on Shabbos, I know in Or Sameach we said Tehillim on Shabbos, which we almost never do. We said Achenu and Tehillim. So in many, many ways, the upside of these great difficulties that we're facing, and Hashem should give us a Yeshua, b'mheira b'yameinu mamish, is that it does create a sense of unity in Achdus Yisrael in a way that we unfortunately do not see when times are better and times are more tranquil. How different people are going down, you know, to the front to bring food and clothing to the chayolim, the tefillos that are said, the care packages, the cards, the messages. All of this is a wonderful, wonderful thing in this cheshech that brings us together. But we do have to know that this is an extraordinary circumstance. And unfortunately, our default setting, when things go back to normal, is we live in a world of stigmatization, of sinas chinam, of, as the Nitziv says, often it stems from religious ideas. Anyone to the right of me is a fanatic. Anyone to the left of me is an apikoros. It's where I am. Whoever the I is, that's the right place. And we have to be misakin that sinas chinam. And as I say, I don't even have to be marich, because it is so prevalent, it is so real, it is so tangible that we see it, you know, every day of our lives. I only live in a certain neighborhood that has only certain types of people and not other types of people. I think there were two kindergartens next to each other. One was a Dati Leumi kindergarten, and one was a Haredi. And the kids, like the Berlin Wall, the kids used to talk between the chain link fence, and in some place they put a big, big tarp over the fence so that there shouldn't be any ability to interact. What has the world come to? Now, you know, you can give a teretz for this and a teretz for that. Okay, so these are things we have to think about. But, I actually want to move away and ask another question. That is, here's the question. When we mourn the Chorban Bayis, are we mourning only the Chorban Bayis Sheni, or are we still mourning the Chorban Bayis Rishon? Now you might say, well listen, we lost the Bayis Rishon, we got it back, so we're mourning the Bayis Sheni, not the Bayis Rishon. But that's not emes. The Rambam writes, based on a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, the Rambam writes in his Perush HaMishnayos to Maseches Rosh Hashanah, that even during the Second Temple, the 420 years of the Bayis Sheni, they fasted on Tisha B'Av. even though they had a Beis HaMikdash, they fasted on Tisha B'Av. Now, if you fast on Tisha B'Av primarily because of the Churban Beis HaMikdash, why would you fast when you have a Beis HaMikdash? So there's actually three different reasons. The Rambam doesn't give you a clear reason, but there are three reasons that are given. Reason number one is, well, listen, the Churban Beis HaMikdash is not the only tragedy of Tisha B'Av. There is the tragedy of the Meraglim, that they weren't able to enter Eretz Yisrael. On the other hand, some of the tragedies like Beitar only happened with the Bayis Sheni, so that couldn't be the explanation. So one is they fasted on Tisha B'Av because of the other tragedies. But that's a little schwer because those were past tragedies. It was over. Reason number two is that Klal Yisrael had a premonition that the second Churban would eventually happen on Tisha B'Av. So Rav Soloveitchik suggests that the fasting in the Bayis Sheni was not mourning over the loss of the temple, but it was in the nature of praying that the other shoe shouldn't fall and there shouldn't be a Churban, meaning every single Tisha B'Av there was a fear. In fact, Rav Soloveitchik wants to be Mechadesh that the Nusach of Tefillah in Tisha B'Av in the Bayis Sheni was not kinais, which are lamentations, they were selichos, prayers for forgiveness that there shouldn't be a Churban again. It's a very interesting chiddush, meaning it was not the Tisha B'Av of mourning over Churban, because they had a Beis HaMikdash, but it was a Tisha B'Av asking Hashem to forgive them that there shouldn't be a Churban. That's Rav Soloveitchik. But the third explanation, which I think might be the best one, is that even when they had the Bayis Sheni, they never got back what they lost in the first Beis HaMikdash. We know, for example, there was no Nevuah. Prophets, right? The last prophets died out. Chagai, Zechariah, Malachi. The last prophets died out at the beginning of the Bayis Sheni. There were no Nevuah. There's even a Lashon in the Mishnah that the Shekhinah did not rest in the Bayis Sheni. The Urim V'Tumim. Now, the Kohen Gadol had the breastplate of the jewels, that he did have, but the prophetic Koach of the Urim V'Tumim did not exist in the Bayis Sheni. That is why, if you remember, in the book of Ezra, when they dedicated the Bayis Sheni under the rule of Persia, there were still some very old people who had remembered the Bayis Rishon 70 years earlier. And that most of the people were singing and dancing and praising Hashem. And the older folk, and there couldn't have been that many of them, they were sobbing, weeping, and crying. And the Pasuk says, amazingly enough, that the sound of their crying and weeping was even louder than the sound of the singing. What were they crying? They have a Beis HaMikdash. They were crying because they knew that the Bayis Sheni was only a very, very partial replacement for the Kedusha of the Bayis Rishon. Because of this, what I want to suggest is that even today, when we fast on Tisha B'Av, we are misabel not only over the Churban Bayis Sheni, we are still misabel over the Churban Bayis Rishon. Now you'll see why that's important. We are thinking, because of course the Bayis Shlishi, which again should be B'mheira V'yameinu, will of course even be greater than the Bayis Rishon. It'll certainly bring everything back. And we're still misabel over the Churban Bayis Rishon, because after all, we're certainly no better than the people who had a Bayis Sheni, who were misabel over the Bayis Rishon. We are misabel over the Bayis Rishon as well. Now, by the way, without getting too technical, if you look at the Psukim in Daniel, you actually see, even in terms of Pashat Pshat of the Psukim, that the 420 years of the Bayis Sheni are considered to be years of Golus. They are added with the 70 years. Meaning to say, we don't consider the 420 years as a redemption of Golus. We consider it as part of the Golus. Meaning, the initial Golus, when the Babylonians destroyed the temple, was supposed to be 490 years, 70 of those years in total Churban, and 420 with a partial Mikdash. And after that time, if we would have been Roy, Mashiach could have come. We were not Roy, so it kept on going. You see from the Sukkim Befesh that the 420 was not envisioned as a geula. It was envisioned as part two of galus, making it a little easier. That's why it says 490 years, 70 weeks. A week in Tanakh is often 7 years. 70 weeks have been decreed on Jerusalem before there can be a redemption. 70 weeks is 70 times 7, 490 years. The Mefarshim explained, the Malbim explains, that that means Hashem decreed a 490 year galus, 70 of which is total galus, 420 of which is a partial galus under foreign rule with a partial Beis Hamikdash, and then to be followed by potential messianic redemption, had we been worthy. It's very important. So, Ebazai, if that's so, we are mourning the Bayis Rishai, not only the Bayis Sheni. Now, why is that important? The reason why it's important and interesting is to go back to the Talmud Yerushalmi. The Talmud Yerushalmi says, again, any generation that is not guilty of the sins of the Chorban would get the temple back. Meaning any generation where the Beis Mikdash is not rebuilt is guilty of the same averus of the Chorban. Now that means the following. If the Bayis Sheni was destroyed because of Sin Aschinam, but the Bayis Rishain was destroyed because of Avodah Zarah, and if we are mourning not only the Chorban Bayis Sheni, but we are mourning the Chorban Bayis Rishay, that means, strangely enough, the Cheshbon HaNefesh we're going through is not only on Sinas Chinam, which is obvious, we have to go through a Cheshbon of Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayis, Shvichas Damim, because we're connecting to the first Mikdash. So the question is, well, gee, I'm not that bad. Okay. Sinas Chinam, okay, unfortunately, you know, we may be guilty of that to a greater or lesser degree, a lack of Avas Yisrael. But Avodah Zarah? What's Avodah Zarah? Gilui Arayis, Shvichas Damim. So I want to talk, this is a little off the beaten track, because most of the talks that we hear, and rightfully so, very rightfully so, focus on Sinas Chinam and the need to work on Avas Yisrael. And that, of course, is very central, and I spoke about it a little today, and I spoke about it on Tuesday. I'll be speaking about it on Tisha B'Av itself. But today I want to talk a little off the beaten track. I want to say, what do we do about Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayis, Shvichas Damim? And what exactly would that mean for us in our situation? So first of all, keep in mind that Chazal tell us that the sins of Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayis, Shvichas Damim can take different forms. For example, the Gemara tells us, Kol HaKoes, if a person has anger, ki ilu oved avodah zarah. So maybe we're not guilty of bowing down to an idol, but if there's kas, if there's anger, that is called a form of idol worship. Now why is that so? Why is that so? Why is kas similar to avodah zarah? So the Bala Tanya writes in the Tanya a beautiful explanation. Avodah zarah is whenever you believe that God is not in charge of the world. Whenever you believe there are forces that are not HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, if I'm angry because somebody hurt me, somebody offended me, if I believe anything that happens to me was decreed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, how could I be angry? Everything Hashem does is L'tov. If I'm angry at you or somebody, it's because I don't have 100% emunah that God runs the world. Ebazai, that's like Avodah Zarah, right? So it's Avodah Zarah because you're replacing Hashem with some other theory of who controls destiny. Be it as it may, we know Avodah Zarah is compared to, or anger is compared to Avodah Zarah. Now, Shvichas Damim, we have a similar idea. Chazal say, Malbin Pnei Chaveiro Barabim. I humiliate somebody publicly. The Ilu Shofech Damim. Remember the Gemara in Saita? It is better for a person to throw themselves to a kifshan ha'esh, a fiery furnace, before they embarrass somebody. And this was the story of Yehuda and Tamar, when Yehuda was with Tamar, not knowing who she was, his own daughter-in-law, and she was pregnant, and Yehuda didn't know because she was disguised. And she's about to be burnt, not so clear what her onus was, but whatever it is, she was considered to have been mizana. She was going to be burnt, and she refused to reveal Yehuda's identity. She simply said, the man that gave me this money belt and this stick, he is the man I was with, and he was Maida. But if he would not have been Maida, she would have gone to her death before she would embarrass him. It's a question whether we paskin exactly that way. Lahalacha, are you literally obligated to give your life? This is machlokas we showed him. But the Gemara says, spiritually, better to die before you humiliate somebody. So the point I'm making is, well, if we still have to think about Avodah Zarah, Gilei Arayos, Shvichas Damim, well, Avodah Zarah includes anger. Shvichas Damim includes Malbin Pnei Chaveira. Gilei Arayos, well, actually that might be an easier thing in a world that is so suffused with didents, sexuality, and hedonism. And even if nobody's actually committing adultery, you know, there's all sorts of bad thoughts or improper thoughts a person could have. Let me also mention, too, an interesting thought. And that is, Gilei Arayos can also find its expression in the emotional distancing between people. Meaning to say, if you have a husband and a wife, even if everybody is faithful in the sense of not doing Gilei Arayos, when there is a coldness in the shalom bias, that is considered to be a form of betrayal and a form of Gilei Arayos. And therefore, the truth of the matter is, even in that sense, when there is a lack of shalom in the home, that is a form of infidelity, that is a form of unfaithfulness. Where do I get that? From Shmuel. If you look in the beginning of Shmuel, Sefer Shmuel, when it talks about Bnei Eli, the sons of Eli. Eli was the Kohen Gadol. And the sons of Eli were behaving improperly. And it mentions in the Navi, what were they doing? That when women would come to the Mishkan in Shiloh to bring their offerings after childbirth, they would sleep with the women, Pesach Oel Moed. Now, if you read the Pasuk literally without any commentary, it basically says they were committing adultery with married women. Now, the Gemara in Shabbos tells us right off the bat that anyone that says that even the children of Eli who were punished were doing that is making a big mistake. So what were they simply doing? A woman after childbirth, you know, the 41st day after the birth of a boy, the 81st day after the birth of a girl, brings a bird offering to the Beis HaMikdash. Now birds are very small. There's not a lot of meat for the Kohanim to eat. I should correct myself. In a bird offering, the Kohen eats nothing at all. It's totally burnt. In animal offerings, there are portions the Kohen eats. So as a result, when a lot of women showed up, the children of Eli put the women in the back of the line so they could get all the good meat offerings. As a result, the women were delayed in coming home to their families. And that is treated as adultery, because they were estranging women from the closeness they could have had to their husbands. A big chiddush. So what do you see from that? At least in biblical morality, it is not simply improper relations that create adultery, but the emotional coldness and distancing between people is Gilei Arayos. So bekitzer, Avodah Zarah could be translated into anger. Gilei Arayos could be translated into lack of shalom within the home, and Shvichas Damim could be Malbin Pnei Chaveiro Barabim. Let me point out as well that the Vilna Gaon writes that it is possible for there to be many types of idols in a person's life. Money can become an idol. Careerism can become an idol. So when we talk about Avodah Zarah, it doesn't necessarily mean that you believe that something else created the world. But whenever something becomes your central focus in life, other than Avodas Hashem, that becomes Avodah Zarah. So money, power, all of these things can become Avodah Zarah Mamish. So in that sense, we still live in a world of Avodah Zarah, Gilei Arayos, Shvichas Damim, because Chazal show us that these Averas can go well beyond the literal. Now, let me mention another point about this. And that is, everyone knows Rav Yosef Karo, the Beis Yosef, the author of the Shulchan Aruch. He was the Rav of Tzfat at a time when Tzfat was filled with great Gedolim and Kedoshim, including the Arizal and the Mekubar Moshe Kodavero and the like. Rav Yosef Karo was much older than the Arizal. Moshe Karo was 70 when the Arizal came to Eretz Yisrael at the age of 36. The Ari died 2.5 years later. But the Ari became the great Makobo. And Rav Yosef Karo used to go to hear the Ari. And he would always fall asleep during the Ari's talk. And the Arizal told him later that HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't want me to be your Rebbe. He thought it was not your kavod, and in your kavod, he didn't allow you to learn from me because you were the gadol of the city. But Rav Yosef Karo was no slouch when it came to Kabbalah. And Rav Yosef Karo actually had a chavrusa with an angel, a malach, that he called his magid, his preacher. And he left us a diary of his conversations with the malach. You can actually get this. It's called Magid Meisharim. These are different discussions he had with his Magid. And in the Magid Meisharim, he recounts the following story, a very interesting story. And some of the details I might be not totally accurate, but this is the gist of the story, certainly. Rav Yosef Karo was once learning a very, very difficult sugya in Maseches Ksuvos. And he worked over this Gemara for weeks and weeks and weeks, and he finally had an insight. He finally understood it. He's walking in Tzfat, you know, those narrow, you know, if you've been to the old city of Tzfat, the narrow areas of Tzfat, and he overhears a shoemaker who is not known as a big Talmud Chacham, who's learning Gemara with his 7-year-old son. And the 7-year-old son asks his father the very kasha that Rav Yosef Karo was thinking about for so many weeks. So I assume Rav Yosef Karo didn't want to eavesdrop, but he was just very curious. The same question, very strange, and from a 7-year-old kid. The shoemaker was very annoyed at his son. He said, I knew this was too hard for you. You're asking a very foolish question. And the answer is so-and-so. And he gave exactly the answer that it took Rav Yosef Karo weeks and weeks to understand. And not only did he give the answer right away, but he implied it was simple, it was obvious, and even a child should have figured it out. So Rav Yosef Karo was very perturbed, because if this was so simple, why wasn't he zocha to understand a simple thing? And he thought that there was some aveira that he had, that Hashem had withheld from him, an understanding of the Torah. So in his diary, he actually asks the Malach, what aveira did I have that I was not able to understand a simple thing until many weeks of work? And the Malach told him it was the opposite. Your understanding of this sugya was very profound, very deep. The world was not deserving of it. But because of your effort, because of your work, because of your struggle, you brought it into existence. Once you brought it into existence, even a kid should have figured it out. Now, from a rational standpoint, this actually makes no sense at all. Because if Yosef Karo didn't teach it to anybody, he didn't communicate it. What do you mean, once he brought it into the world, everybody should figure it out? But the answer is, that's the way holiness works. When we do Torah, we do mitzvahs, even if we're doing it privately, nobody knows, nobody sees. The world changes. We bring holiness into the world. The world is different. So when people say, and again, without getting into, I don't want to get another letter about discussing whether yeshiva boys should be in the army. I'm not going to discuss that issue right now. So don't send me anything on it. But when people say, oh, you're just sitting in the Beis HaMedrash, what are you accomplishing? That's, at least as an idea, that's totally false. There is Kedusha that comes into the world. There is godliness that comes into the world. The world changes. The Chafetz Chaim used to say that the intensity of the learning in Radin, the little hamlet of Radin that didn't even have a train station, the intensity of learning in Radin determined the length of the dresses in Paris. Meaning to say, it's like a nuclear bomb. Right, you have ground zero where the radiation is most intense. You go further and further out, the radiation is less intense, but it still has negative effects. Torah and mitzvahs is the same thing. We do Torah and mitzvahs. It radiates outward. It changes the world. So maybe if in Radin they were learning 18 hours a day or 15 hours a day. So by the time it reached Moscow, maybe 10 hours a day. By the time it reached Paris, maybe there was a daily minyan and the dresses went below the knee. But it had an effect. What that means, therefore, is this. going back to Avodah Zarah, Gila, Rashi, Chazam, let's say we as good Jews, we're not guilty of any of that. We're not guilty of Avodah Zarah, Gila, Araya, Shvi, Chastamim. But we do live in a world, we certainly live in a world of Shvi, Chastamim, a world of violence, a world of death. We live in a world of Gila, Araya. We live in a world of Avodah Zarah, at least if you look at money and materialism. So even if I'm not guilty, since I know, we know, that our Torah and our mitzvahs could have changed the world for better, if I see a world of evil and a world of sin, I am responsible. Now I know, you know, we don't like to have a guilt trip. And the MS is like this. The MS is, you know, anti-Semites like to say that Jews are responsible for all the world's evil. But I hate to say that anti-Semites have a point, although not the point that they mean. And that is, we do have the capacity to change the nature of the world. Not necessarily through political means, and not necessarily through even proselytization and making speeches. But our Torah, our mitzvahs, our tefillah, our chesed, our avas Yisrael, makes the world somewhat of a different place. And therefore, conversely, therefore, when I look at a world and I see Avodah Zarah, Gila, Shvi, Chastamim, I have a certain responsibility for that. And therefore I am still misabel, not just sinas chinam, which of course we unfortunately have, but even Avodah Zarah, Gila, Shvi, Chastamim. The Gemara in Masechet Shabbos tells us that at the time of the Chorban of the Bayis Rishon, Hashem instructed a malach to go and put an invisible mark on the foreheads of the tzaddikim, that they shouldn't get killed. In other words, that the Malach HaMavis shouldn't be able to get them. And the Midas Adin, the attribute of justice, asked Hashem, what are you doing? And Hashem says, these are tzaddikim who didn't sin. I'm going to save them. And the Malach HaMavis said, what do you mean they didn't sin? But they could have stopped the evil that other people did. And the Midas HaRachamim said, but Hashem, you know if they would have tried to stop it, it wouldn't have been effective. But the last word was the Malach HaMavis. Hashem, you knew, but how did they know? Meaning there's an obligation to try to stop evil in any way we can. And that does mean by taking the military, political, and spiritual activities. But what I'm saying is even going beyond that. That is, even what we do in the privacy of our homes has a koach to change the world. And that's the second reason. So far we've given two explanations. Why are we thinking about Avodah Zarah, Gilei Shvi Chastamim? One is that these Averis take different forms, right? Avodah Zarah could be the anger, Gilei Arayis could be emotional estrangement, Shvi Chastamim could be humiliation. That's explanation number one. Explanation number two is, even if it's not my Avodah Zarah, it's not my Shvi Chastamim, it's not my Gilei Arayis, since we live in a world where this is going on, we have a certain achrayas for not creating the kedusha that could make it better. But then there's a third explanation, again from Rav Tzadok, and over these weeks we've mentioned Rav Tzadok of Lublin quite a lot of times, in which he says, the great sins of Avodah Zarah, Gilei Arayis, Shvi Chastamim, are really symptoms. They are not roots. They are symptoms of character flaws that are very, very deep. And even if a person does not have the symptom, they can have the illness that will give rise to the symptom. What is the illness? The illness is a statement in Pirkei Avos, Rabbi Elazar HaKapor, that says, Hakina v'hataiva v'hakavot Motzien es ha'adam min ha'olam. Kina is jealousy, envy. Taiva is an excessive lust for material and sensual pleasure. I say excessive because the Torah recognizes this as a legitimate part of life, but excessive. And kavod is desire for glory and ego gratification. These three negative factors, they destroy a person. They make them unable to connect to Hashem. They make them unable to have a spiritual life in which their neshama can be a mishkan for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, a dwelling place. So Rav Tzedek says very simply, if you look at kinah, jealousy, jealousy taken to its extreme will create murder. How many murders, certainly most criminal murders, arise out of jealousy, out of rivalries, out of desire to take what somebody else has? Sometimes you kill a person, or people kill because they want someone's sneakers, they want somebody's coat. This comes from a jealousy. You have something I want. Right, if you remember O.J. Simpson, etc. Well, whatever it would be. So, kinah, and of course, I don't have to prove anything more than the very first murder in the Torah. The murder of Cain. Cain kills Hevel. Cain kills Hevel because of jealousy. Hashem accepts the korban of Hevel. Hashem does not accept the korban of Cain. Cain is enraged. Why does he have that relationship that I don't have? And he kills Hevel out of the anger and fury of being jealous. So the shayrish of Shvichas Damim is kinah. So yes, maybe I don't have the symptom of being a murderer, but the root cause of jealousy and envy can still exist within me. Gilui Arayus, of course, is the extreme manifestation of taiva, lust. A person can have lust for many things. It can culminate in Gilui Arayus, but that taiva is a shorish. Now, the last one is a bit more complicated. Reb Tzedek claims the shayrish, the root that leads people to idolatry, is actually kavod, ego. How is that so? Because people want to construct a religion that lets them be in charge of their lives. Now, in the ancient idolatry, if you consider the old pagan religions, the old gods, small g, of course, were very indifferent about morality. In fact, if you think about it, the Greek gods were just as decadent and immoral, if not more so, than the human beings. Talk about, instead of the human being made in the image of Hashem, these idolatrous cultures made gods in the image of man. So, Rav Tzedek says, when a human being's ego, I want to be in charge of my life. I want to be the one that makes decisions. It's like shooting the arrow and then drawing the target around the arrow. You create the religion as a way of justifying whatever it is you want to do. So the ultimate shoresh of Avodah Zarah is the notion of kavod. And to put it another way as well, one of the greatest forms of idolatry that can exist is when I worship the human being. We worship at the altar of science, at the altar of technology, at the altar of all that we can do. Because indeed, it's a very enticing thought, because man is made in the image of God. And man has godly powers. God has given the human race a certain sense of divine power. We can destroy the world. We can create so much within the world. Although you know the old joke about the scientist who was working on creating spontaneous generation of organic living matter from inorganic. And he was working with the chemicals and electricity and the like, and he finally created life out of dirt. So he says to God, he says, God, there is no longer a difference between you and I. You created life from dirt. I created life from dirt. We have obliterated the division between man and God. So God responds, next time use your own dirt. So the point is, no matter what we can do, there's still going to be that great division. But the point basically is, Rav Tzedek says, that sometimes the biggest Avodah Zarah is when I make myself an Avodah Zarah. I become the God. I become the judge. I become the one who determines what is right and wrong. And my religion is simply a reflection of the results that I want to get. So Rav Tzedek's insight is, Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayus, Shvichas Damim are simply extreme manifestations of the root shirashim of kinah, jealousy, which is Shvichas Damim, taiva, which is Gilui Arayus, and kavod, that is Avodah Zarah. putting myself first instead of Hashem. In this connection, I just want to share with you a beautiful, very interesting thought. That is, I know you've heard of the Gemara that says that when a person does a mitzvah that they're commanded to do, they get more reward than if they do a mitzvah they're not commanded to do. Now, an example would be a woman. Women are paturot from many time-bound commandments, like sukkah, like lulav. And yet, if they do them, they get schar. They do get reward for those mitzvahs. But Chazal teach us the mitzvah you get, the reward you get for a mitzvah you didn't have to do, you still get reward, is not as great as the reward you get for a mitzvah you have to do. That's called mitzvah v'yoseh versus eino mitzvah v'yoseh. You still get reward. So the question people ask is, well, wait a second, I would think the opposite is the case. If I gotta do something, so I gotta do it. So, you know, I'm just doing my job. But if I do extra credit, right, if I could, that's why time and a half overtime, right? You get your hourly wage for the regular hours, you get extra money for coming in overtime. If I'm doing more than I have to do, shouldn't I get more reward? Tosfos says a fascinating psychological insight. When I do something I don't have to do, I have the ego satisfaction that I'm in charge. I decide. I'm the boss. I do it. There's no Yetzirah against that. As soon as you're commanded to do something, there's a Yetzer Hara, I don't want to do it. We're rebellious. It is much harder. That's why you'll sometimes find a kid may learn very, very well before his bar mitzvah, and after his bar mitzvah has a certain yiridah, because now he has to learn, right? So now it's a chiv. That's also why in the Reform movement, the only people who wear tefillin are women. Tefillin wearing is fairly popular among women, as well as daily tefillah b'tzibur, or whatever it is. And the reason is, they don't have to do it. So it's great to do it. When you have to do it, you don't want to do it. And you know, this happens with all of us. I mean, I know myself, you know, without being too autobiographical here. You know, husband is about to take out the garbage to do a nice favor to his wife. And as he's about to take out the garbage, wife says, please take out the garbage. Okay, hopefully your husband will still take out the garbage, but there'll be a certain feeling, well, you know, maybe I'm not going to do it now. I don't like to do it because I'm told to do it. I like to do it because I want to do it. So, the concept is, even in our religious life, we like to be the one in charge. We like to be the boss. And Rav Tzadok says that she'ifa kavod, an ego, is connected to avodah zarah. Rav Chaim Shulevitz used to bring a wonderful proof for this. And maybe Rav Hirsch covered it in the Shmuel share. Do you remember the character of Shimi ben Gera? So Shimi ben Gera was a relative of Shaul, and when David is running away from Avshalom, his own son, who wants to kill him, so Shimi ben Gera is throwing rocks at him and saying, you deserve it, you deserve it, you deserve it, because you're a Rasha, and you took away the Malchus from Shaul, and Hashem is punishing you. And Yoav wanted to kill Shimi, and David HaMelech uttered the very immortal words that if Hashem didn't want me to be cursed, this wouldn't have happened. I am makabel this bizayon as part of a gezeira of Hashem. Again, I think back, perhaps I should have been makabel my little bizayon, but okay. I'm not on that madrega. But anyway, but the question is, David on his deathbed took a different tack. David on his deathbed tells Shlomo HaMelech, go get him. Now that's Bechlal Akasha. What happened to the attitude of it all comes from Hashem? So part of the answer is that David did not want to punish Shimi when David was personally upset, because then it would have been a personal thing. After reflection and thought, he decides that this is the Torah requires this punishment, so it's appropriate. Okay, but be it as it may, what was the plan that Shlomo devised? He tells Shimi ben Gera, Shlomo tells Shimi ben Gera, don't go out of the city. You're under city arrest. Not even house arrest. City arrest. Don't leave the city. The day you leave the city, dam of Barosho, your blood is on your head. So what happens? Shimi loses some donkeys. He goes out. Of course, he's being watched very carefully. He gets apprehended. He gets killed. Rav Chaim Shulevitz used to say, what type of idiot is he? He knows he's going to be killed if he steps out of the city. Shimi ben Gera is a wealthy man. He has servants. He could have sent the servants out, unlike Shaul, who was a young man at the time, but Shaul had no death sentence when he's looking for his donkeys.
So Shimi leaves the city to look for donkeys? This wasn't like, you know, going to his mother's levaya or something. This was a trivial matter that could have easily been handled by other people. Why is he risking his life? Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, had Shimi been told, had not been told he couldn't leave, he wouldn't have bothered to leave. He certainly would have said, get somebody else. But once a human being is told you can never leave, it becomes unbearable. I have to get out of here. A person will even risk his life when he's told you have to stay here. I mean, again, how would you feel? Let's say somebody would say to you, I can't hear you ask, you might be the halachi, you never leave Eretz Yisrael. Which actually might in fact be the halacha. Well, the truth of the matter is, for most of us, at that, even though we weren't planning on leaving at all, I mean, never. I feel claustrophobic. I got to go to Sweden. I got to go to Denmark. You know, got to get out of here. Cyprus, even. You know, nice half an hour trip. There's a nice Chabad house in Cyprus, by the way. So the thing is, Rav Chaim Shmulevitz says, human beings intrinsically rebel against authority. We don't want to be told what to do. We want to be in charge. And even in our Avodas Hashem, we want to be the ones who make decisions. Rav Tzadok says, that is Kavod, and that is the Shorish of Avodah Zarah. And therefore, because when you're not putting Hashem as number one, then you're essentially worshipping yourself. And therefore, Rav Tzadok says, even though we lost the Bayis Sheni, we are still being misabel over the Chorban Bayis Rishayim, because we still have within our personalities the root causes of Avodah Zarah, Gilui Arayos, Shvichus Damim. Again, let me just end with a comforting word. On one hand, the Talmud Yerushalmi tells us that any generation which does not build the Beis HaMikdash is as guilty as the generation that destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. That's one thought. But the Sfas Emes adds the following. We know that one of the malachos of Shabbos is bona, one of the lamites malachos, is building. How much building do you have to do to be considered to be a builder? Like, what is the shiur? What is the quantity of building? If I add a brick. So the Gemara says, the shiur of bona is kol shehu. Any amount that you add to a building is halachically called building. So the Sfas Emes says, maybe our job is not necessarily to complete the whole Beis HaMikdash. That requires many, many zechusim. But at least we have to be a partial builder of the Beis HaMikdash. We have to be people who add a brick, add something. And with our mitzvos, our masim tovim, our avas Yisrael, our tikkun hamidos in both bein adam lamakom, bein adam lechaveira, we are adding inch by inch, brick by brick, something to that Beis HaMikdash in Shemayim. And when all of those bricks are in place, then that bayis shlishi is going to be yored min haShemayim, to bring a geula to all of Klal Yisrael. May it be b'mheira v'yameinu.